This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says it has finalized its views on the US's response to an EU draft text for the revival of the JCPOA and has submitted them to the EU coordinator. The leader of Ansarullah movement says the Yemeni army is upgrading its combat capabilities to defend the country and all enemies' efforts have ended in failure. A US military report says sexual assault among women has reached tragic and devastating levels with a year-on-year increase of roughly 13%. Thank you for joining us. Tehran says it has submitted its views on the US's response to an EU draft text on reviving the 2015 deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says an Iran expert team carefully reviewed the US response and submitted its views to the EU coordinator. Kanani says the text Iran sent has a constructive approach aimed at finalizing the negotiations. Earlier, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the Islamic Republic has shown its good will and determination to reach a strong and lasting agreement on the revival of the landmark accord. Tehran says it seeks stronger guarantees from the US to have a sustainable agreement. The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement has warned the Saudi-led coalition that it would fail in its attempt to occupy the country and dominate the Yemeni nation. Abdul Malik al-Houthi was speaking on the occasion of a military parade held in the city port city of Hodeidah. He hailed the country's forces, saying they have proved their capabilities by turning enemies' plots to occupy Yemen into an illusion and nightmare. Al-Houthi said the Yemeni nation will continue to defend its freedom and independence. The Ansarullah leader underlined that aggressors could not move the nation away from its fundamental positions, including on the issue of Palestine, and all their efforts ended in failure. Al-Houthi pledged that the military would continue upgrading its combat capabilities in naval, air, land, and missile manufacturing domains. Joining us to discuss the Saudi war on Yemen is Hamza Karim, Yemeni activist and political commentator from Canada. Thank you very much for joining us. Please, Hamza, give us your insights on the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen. We heard Yemen's Ansarullah leader earlier saying that the Saudi-led coalition will never succeed in occupying the country despite its ruthless military strikes. What is your take on this?
Obviously, as everyone knows, the war has been going on for Yemen for almost 8 years now. There has been a truce that was signed almost 5 months ago, and after 1 month it will end. During this 8 years, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and the Western governments that are backing them have used all their cards. They've committed all type of war crimes in Yemen. They have imposed a blockade on airports and ports, and with one goal, which is occupying Yemen. But after all, they couldn't achieve their goal, and they weren't able to impose the government that was overthrown back in 2014. Now, this truth is the truce that is going on right now is ending on October 1st, 2022, which is a month from now. I think the parade today sent very clear and strong messages to people inside Yemen and outside Yemen. For the people inside Yemen, I think the message was clear that, you know, if Saudi Arabia did not commit to the truce and to the conditions that we agreed to, which is paying salaries for people, lifting the blockade on airports and ports in Yemen and leaving Yemen totally from all the lands of Yemen, then we're ready. We're ready to continue our fight. We're ready to liberate Yemen, and we're ready to force these countries to lift the blockade on Yemen and kick them outside of Yemen. Now, and the message that is sent to Saudi Arabia, UAE, and the countries behind them is that after 8 years, you couldn't achieve anything. Our military capabilities have been improving since then. We're ready, like no time before, to go back to this war and fight for our rights and freedom and independence. And there shouldn't be, you know, we're ready for this. So I think it was a very clear message to both people inside Yemen and outside Yemen.
Okay, Hamza, like you said, the Saudi-led blockade of Yemen has miserably failed in preventing the nation's military advances, and Yemenis are now attacking the aggressors. What is the reason behind the failure of the aggressors and the success of the Yemenis?
I think the you know, the reason for what each side is fighting for, on one side you have Yemeni people represented by Ansar Allah. They're fighting for their rights, they're fighting for their freedom, they are fighting, they're defending themselves. Actually, they're not aggressors. They've been aggressed by Saudi Arabia and UAE, while on the other hand you have Saudi Arabia supporting different militias, which they are fighting among themselves. And they have no goal or objective of this war but to destroy Yemen. I think this really made the difference here. Although on the other hand, you see Saudi Arabia have, you know, all the money in the world. They have all the media supporting them. They have all the latest and the greatest, you know, military technology and arms. Yet they couldn't achieve anything because in Yemen have strong, you know, motives. Their motives are not as strong as the Yemeni people and Ansar Allah's motives, which is defending their land and fighting for their freedom and independence.
Absolutely. It's been very nice to have you on our show, Hamza Karim, joining us from Toronto, Canada. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be sure to join you again in the later news bulletins to hear more of your insights. Thank you very much for joining us. Moving on, the U.S. military experienced its highest recorded level of sexual assault among women last year. That's according to new findings published by the Pentagon. The survey shows sexual assault saw an increase of roughly 13% in 2021 compared to the previous year. The figures also indicate that more than 8% of active duty women are estimated to have experienced some form of unwanted sexual contact. The Pentagon describes the findings as, quote, tragic, disappointing, and devastating. The data shows a large portion of women in the U.S. military do not trust the system to treat them with dignity and respect and ensure their safety after an incident. It was a case of morality and human concern. A Google employee quit the giant internet company Google over her views on censorship and Palestine. She believed that censoring news on Palestine through the cooperation of Google and Israel was an injustice to Palestinians. Her objection led to other Google employees quitting in protest. This was also a clear case of profiting off Israeli occupation.
The dirty espionage ties between giant tech company Google and the Israeli regime is back on the front burner. The story became headline after a Jewish worker of the company quit a post over Google's support for Israel. Ariel Koran is a marketing manager for Google's educational products and worked for the company for 7 years. She's written a memo to announce her resignation from the company over a support for Israel's crackdown against Palestinians. She has accused the company of retaliating against employees who spoke out in support of Palestine. She says Google has, quote, created an environment of fear for employees who support Palestine. Instead of listening to employees who want Google to live up to its ethical principles, Google is aggressively pursuing military contracts and stripping away the voices of its employees through a pattern of silencing and retaliation towards me and many others. She spent more than a year campaigning against the Project Nimbus with the Israeli military. She helped circulate petitions and talk to news organizations in a bid to pressure the company to reconsider the hefty project. But the company's response to her anti-Israel campaign was blunt and threatening. Relocate to Sao Paulo in Brazil within 17 business days or lose your job. 15 other Google employees have also raised their voices, urging the company to cut its business ties with Israel and review its treatment of Palestinians.
And the contract actually explicitly allows the Israeli government, including the Israeli military and the Israel Land Authority, to use the services however they would wish without the companies having any sort of right to regulate the way that the services are being used. And so as workers, in addition to having this kind of end goal that our companies will rescind these contracts, one of our goals is to emphasize that you can't enter into a business contract as a company that doesn't allow for the company itself to regulate the way that those services are being used. That is completely, it's unethical and it's dangerous, right? And as workers, one of the things that we're pushing for is our right to transparency. When we're putting our labor into building out services, how do those services get used? It's our right to understand that and to have transparency. And one of the things that frightens us about Project Nimbus specifically is that it almost feels that it's serving as a sort of testing ground for Google and Amazon's ability to fulfill military contracts where employees have no voice.
Ariel Koren, who herself is Jewish, has said that Google pressured her into resigning. She believed that the Project Nimbus would be used by Israel to commit human rights abuses against Palestinians. She said this would happen through the use of facial recognition and other machine learning surveillance and profiling tools.
Google's part in the controversial Nimbus project was unveiled in May 2021 as Israel was busy slaughtering Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The $1.2 billion project Nimbus, which is a partnership between Google, Amazon, and Israel, will provide the regime with a cloud computing system. The technology will give the Israeli military artificial intelligence technology and machine learning tools.
These contracts were signed the exact same week that we saw over 260 people in Gaza murdered at the hands of the Israeli military. And that, to, you know, exactly the way Batul said it, it would have been really scary for us to see our technology being used in this way at any time. But the fact that this was the timing that was chosen doesn't seem like a coincidence to us. One other thing that I would add is the fact that the contracts themselves actually include a clause that explicitly basically disallows employee activism to actually lead to the contracts being rescinded. So the contracts in and of themselves protect against any sort of action from the companies to rescind the contracts in the event that employee activism emerges from the existence of these contracts.
The technology will allow Israel to increase its crackdown against Palestinians and further curtail the dwindling rights of the Palestinians in the occupied territories. It would also significantly enhance the surveillance of Palestinians and help expand Israel's illegal settlements on the occupied Palestinian lands.
Well, of course. I mean, Israel is not only silencing Palestinian voices. I mean, in truth, they're silencing Palestinian lives. I mean, every day we see videos out of Palestine with Israeli soldiers attacking children, arresting children, shutting down NGOs. Destroying, you know, Palestinian houses, sometimes making Palestinians destroy their own houses. Of course, Israel has killed some Palestinian journalists. Yeah, I mean, they are trying to silence the Palestinian people in a very profound way, and particularly those that are critical of Israel.
However, Google is not the only U.S. tech giant which is pro-Israel. Other platforms like Facebook and Instagram, which are owned by the same parent company, Meta, have already been accused of removing posts displaying Israel's brutality against Palestinians, like bombardments of the neighborhoods in the Gaza Strip by the Israeli Air Force. The platforms have also been accused of censoring the voices of Palestinians raised against Israeli occupation.
A Palestinian rights group says the Israeli regime has killed 112 people in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip since the beginning of 2022. According to a report by the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, over 1,200 civilians were also injured during Israel's repeated attacks against Palestinians. That includes nearly 200 children and 40 women. According to the report, 32 civilians, including 8 children, were killed during a recent aggression on Gaza in August alone. The report also adds that Palestinians have been subjected to hundreds of repeated Israeli crimes, such as raids on buildings and holy sites, as well as storming and demolition of homes. The center has labeled Israeli operations as war crimes, saying they violated all international laws and conventions. In Pakistan, floods continue to wreak havoc, tear up homes and take lives. Now, the devastation is expected to take a further turn for the worse over the next few days. Officials in the southern province of Sindh say they are on high alert as a surge of water is arriving downstream from northern flooding. Sindh is the hardest hit province. It received around 8 times its average rains in August. A third of Pakistan is already inundated with floods triggered by record monsoon and melting glaciers in the northern mountains. The natural disaster has displaced many and swept away homes, infrastructure and roads across the waterlogged towns and villages. There is growing risk of waterborne diseases too. The World Health Organization says over 6.4 million people are in dire need of humanitarian aid. The climate catastrophe has killed over 1,100 people so far. Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Thank you for joining us.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. CEO pay rose 18.2% faster than the U.S. inflation rate of 7.1%, a new analysis finds. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jay Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. CEOs, not working people, are causing inflation. Report shows soaring executive pay. Here's more. The AFL-CIO's latest annual analysis of top executive pay was published recently with the following conclusion. CEOs, not working people, are causing inflation. In recent months, corporate bosses and top Federal Reserve officials have pointed to workers' wages as a factor in surging prices, which have pushed overall inflation in the United States to a four-decade high. Runaway CEO pay is a symptom of greedflation, when companies increase prices to boost corporate profits and create windfall payouts for corporate CEOs. But the AFL-CIO's new report attempts to reframe the national inflation discussion, emphasizing that while wage increases won by ordinary workers are drawing outsized attention from policymakers and executives, CEO pay hikes significantly outpaced the wage increases of rank-and-file employees last year. Titled Greedflation, the report shows that in 2021, CEOs of S&P 500 companies received on average $18.3 million in total compensation. The analysis finds CEO pay rose 18.2% faster than the U.S. inflation rate of 7.1%. The new analysis says, in contrast, U.S. workers' wages fell behind inflation. With worker wages rising only 4.7% in 2021, the average S&P 500 company CEO-to-worker pay ratio was 324-1. The highest-paid executive among S&P 500 companies last year was Expedia's Peter Kern, who brought in an eye-popping $296 million in total compensation. Other executives at the top of 2021 list were Amazon CEO Andy Jassy, Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger, Apple CEO Tim Cook, and JP Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon. Runaway CEO pay is a symptom of greedflation when companies increase prices to boost corporate profits and create windfall payouts for corporate CEOs, the new analysis states. During a conference call outlining the report's findings, AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Fred Redmond said that when you look at those numbers and at CEOs trying to blame workers for inflation, it just doesn't add up. In his remarks during an earnings call earlier last year, for instance, Amazon's chief financial officer attributed inflationary pressures felt within the company during the final quarter of 2021 to wage increases and incentives in the operations. But Redmond pointed out that last year Amazon delivered the highest CEO to worker pay ratio in the S&P 500 index with a pay ratio of 6,474-1. In a blog post recently, economist Dean Baker similarly argued that soaring executive pay is contributing to inflation, which has eroded modest wage gains that many ordinary workers have seen since late 2020. We transfer tens of billions of dollars upward to CEOs and other top corporate executives through the corrupt corporate governance structure that we have instituted, writes Baker, a senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. In this context, it is not surprising that even Medicare COs can get paychecks in tens of millions of dollars annually. And it is not just the CEO. If the CEO gets $20 million, the chief financial officer might get $10 to $12 million, and even third-tier executives may get $2 to $3 million. He added, "This is all inflationary." The AFL and CIO's analysis was released as the Federal Reserve gears up to hike interest rates by another 75 basis points at its upcoming policy meeting, a move that economists fear could push the U.S. economy closer to recession. The second consecutive 75/10th percentage point rate hike is expected despite evidence that key drivers of inflation, such as gas prices, are cooling. Wage growth has also slowed substantially in recent months, prompting experts to warn that additional rate increases could slash wages by driving up the unemployment rate, a potential disaster for millions of Americans. Josh Bivens, the director of research at Economic Policy Institute, noted, "Higher unemployment lowers wage growth much more reliably and by larger amounts than it lowers inflation. Currently, wage growth is decelerating. This means there is no genuine need for a recession to put wage growth down to sustainable levels." The AFL-CIO's Redmond echoed that sentiment, declaring that we need to raise wages to help working people cope with rising prices, not make working people poorer by causing a recession.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. I'm your host, Zainab Askari. Well, we have heard about the events of Karbala and women who had played important role in it. But there's a question that whether women before the moment of Karbala, were there women during the Karbala, we know that, but were there women post-Karbala and what was their role? We got to talk about all that in our studio with Siddiqa. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you for having me today. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Siddiqa. Thank you so much for accepting the invitation. A very warm welcome.
Thank you.
All right, so we are understanding over here that Salat is so important. They understand, everybody recognizes it as one of the most important pillars of Islam, and they do not forget it even through this tragic event.
So Hazrat Zainab, like you mentioned, where did she get the strength? You see, the whole event of Karbala, they had that faith in Allah. When we have tragic events in our families,
yeah,
we forget that this is from Allah, it's a test from Allah. But Hazrat Zainab, when Imam Hussein has died and they're being taken to Kufa, she throws herself from the camel, she puts her hand under the body and says, "Allah, accept this little sacrifice from us."
Okay.
And this strength, this constant belief that Allah is watching me, Allah is with me, whatever I do, I will do it for Allah, gave her the strength to remember that this is from Allah. I know I'm on the right path. I know Allah is with me. And therefore, if I forget my namaz, my spiritual status will fall. My connection with Allah will sever.
Yeah.
And if we teach our children to make justifications, we are allowing them to start severing that bond with Allah.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we have to be very careful in our upbringing with children. Even if it is Fajr, do not let them do Qadha.
Yeah.
If you have to force them, initially you have to, because that's how they will learn.
Yeah.
But go for it. Alright, so this was about Salat. So do we have something about eating etiquettes we learned from these lessons, like we learned from all these roles the women have played?
So when the Ahlul Bayt were taken to Kufa, the people of Kufa, the women of Kufa, were throwing dates for these children to eat.
Okay.
Right? These children were very hungry, right? But these are the Ahlul Bayt. Sadaqa is haram.
Yeah.
Hadha Umm Kulthum. There is a whole historical discussion on who she was,
yeah,
whether she truly was there. But from the narrations I've read, it was Hazrat Umm Kulthum. And this, I believe, is also present in the book Nafasul Mahmum.
Okay.
I believe. She takes the dates from their mouths, throws it away, and tells the people of Kufa, don't you know sadaqa is haram on us, the Ahlul Bayt?
Okay.
What she's basically teaching here is eat halal.
Okay.
Eat what is allowed. Do not allow haram food to enter your stomachs. And we see Imam Hussein, you know, on the day of...
Even if you're hungry.
Even if you're hungry, try your best. I understand in some cases we do waver.
Yeah.
But you know, Imam Hussein, on the day of Ashura, he's talking to the people of Kufa. It is said everyone who came to fight against Imam Hussein were all Kufians. And they are the ones who wrote the letters to Imam Hussein. They were completely aware of who Imam Hussein was. Imam Hussein calls out some of them by their names and says, didn't you invite me to come and guide you? They say, we don't know what he's talking about. Imam Hussein tells them, no, your stomachs are filled with haram. That's why you've come to fight me today.
Okay.
So haram food that enters our stomach has an impact that we cannot imagine. These people fed themselves haram so much that they were ready to blind themselves, close their ears, and brutally and mercilessly kill not anyone, kill the son of the Prophet.
Okay.
Some scholars like Ayatollah Behjat, who was a very great spiritual scholar based in Qom, he was also a jurist.
Yeah.
He used to say, do not even allow doubtful food to enter your stomach.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
What are the other lessons that we learned from the role of women?
These women who accompanied Imam Hussein or who fought for his movement, his cause, they show us that we have to support the Imam of the time, and your gender, age, race, nothing matters.
Nothing matters.
We even had some of the servants from the house of the Ahlul Bayt who accompanied the Imam, protected his children,
okay,
and supported his movement throughout.
Okay.
Like Lady Fidda. She was someone who served in the house of Hazrat Fatima,
okay,
and later accompanied Imam Hussein and his family to Karbala. Hazrat Fidda, it is said about her that this woman for 20 years only spoke using the Quran. If okay. anyone would speak to her, she would speak using the Quran as her language.
Okay.
That means she was so well versed with the Quran. Now she had an excuse. I'm a woman. I don't need to go. I'm a servant. I can sit behind and serve the rest of the family. Like she served Hazrat Fatima. She has an excellent excuse to say, look, I've already done my job. I've served your family. Let me go now. But she doesn't do that. She accompanies Imam Hussein all the way to Karbala through all the tragedies that happened and back to Medina. Not allowing an excuse that I have served your family, now let me go.
Yeah.
Then we have other, like I said, age even doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Over here we had some of the children of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. I believe his name was Abdullah. Imam Hussein was being killed, right? Abdullah leaves Hazrat Zainab. Hazrat Zainab is holding on to Abdullah because he tries to rush off to protect Imam Hussein.
Okay.
She's holding on to him, but he was a very young child. She's holding on to him, but he struggles away from her and reaches to the help of the Imam. This in itself is evidence that when the Imam is in difficulty, your age doesn't matter.
You have
to be there to protect him. Then we go to
even if you're bound with the emotions, you're being stopped. It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
Then we go to the gender. We see, you know, Imam Hussein in the earlier part of the battle told Umm Wahab, like we mentioned earlier, when she tried to go to fight the army,
yeah,
he tells her jihad is not wajib on women. And this is because the men are still present.
Yeah.
Now, Imam Hussein is on the battlefield. He is going to be killed. Hazrat Zainab runs to protect him. And this is evidence that when the imam is in difficulty, it doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman.
Yeah.
Jihad becomes wajib on you.
True.
She runs to protect him. And she's standing next to him. You know, she's with him. Imam Hussein is trying to tell her, get back. She's not willing to let go.
Yeah.
He tells her, get back. She's not willing to let go. Shimar comes and whips her and pulls her away. And this is how he separates her. And we refer back to how Hazrat Zahra in Medina did the same thing. She was holding on to Imam Ali. We've discussed this in one of the previous episodes.
True.
Imam Ali is being dragged away to forcefully give allegiance to the caliph of the time.
Yeah.
Hazrat Zainab holds onto his dress. She's been told, let go. She doesn't let go.
Yeah.
Let go. She doesn't let go. They whip her hand. It is said that the way they pulled the two apart, that some of the dress of Imam Ali as well tore.
Sister Sadiqa, you were talking about defending the Imam of time, regardless of your gender. And now you gave us two very beautiful examples of Lady Fatima Salamullah Alayha and Lady Zainab.
When it comes to even defending the Imam of the time or defending the religion or the movement of religion, there's always going to be a need for sacrifice.
Yeah.
It is very difficult to sacrifice what we have. And this is why in Akhlaq we have a concept of Zuhud.
Yeah.
Zuhud does not mean having things. It means not being attached to those things.
All right.
And these women who accompanied Imam had this zuhud in them. They had this detachment to what they had. They had children, but they raised them for the Imam. They raised them for the religion. They had wealth. Imam Hussein was not a poor man.
Okay.
Imam Hussein was very rich. Yeah. To the extent he actually bought the land of Karbala before he died, so he could be buried there. These people were not poor when they went to Karbala. They were very rich, but they didn't have attachment to what they had.
All right.
And these women as well, they sacrificed their children for this path. And we know that every woman, like we mentioned some of the examples previously, they would prepare their sons to go to the battle. Ali Akbar went. He was a very young man. Imam Hussein even gives him away in the path of Allah. This is sacrifice. Sometimes it's easy to let go of your wealth.
Yeah.
We had some of the people who accompanied Imam Hussein all the way till Karbala. But when they saw that things were getting hard, they're like, I'm giving you my horse, I'm giving you my money, but I can't give you my life. And they would run away.
All right.
When it comes to defending Islam, sacrifice does not mean letting go of it. It just means giving away in the path of Allah. And when you give away something in the path of Allah, you will be returned tenfold of it.
This is also answer to all of those who put on these doubts in Islam, that who say that religion only belongs to the poor. But we see that the family of Ahlul Bayt, who are rich, who are like Imam Hassan al-Islam, who gave away his property not just once, not just twice, but more than two times. And for the third time, he gives like more than half of his property. And
three times he gave it completely. I think another two, three times he gave half of it away.
All right. So it's not an easy thing to do, like to give away everything you have. Getting detached from what you have is another lesson.
Yes, maintaining the zuhud that these women had.
Yeah.
They loved the children, but they realized that attachment is a different thing, because these people had reached a spiritual status where they realized, if Allah has given me a child, and if I give my child away in the path of Allah,
they have realized that child is amana.
They've realized the value of what God has given them. This God has given them a gift.
Trust.
They brought these children up in the right way and then gave them away. The Onan Muhammad, the children of Hazrat Zainab, the family of the Prophet after Karbala, Kufa, Sham, returned back to Medina. The people go to pay their respects to the husband of Hazrat Zainab. I think his name was Abdullah ibn Ja'far.
Okay.
And they go to pay the respects. So the servant of Abdullah ibn Ja'far tells them, this tragedy has come on us because of Imam Hussein.
Oh.
Yeah. Abdullah ibn Ja'far takes a shoe and throws it on him. He's like, don't you dare say that. For me, it is a source of pride that if I couldn't physically be there in Karbala, my two children went and supported this cause. It has become a source of pride that I could sacrifice my children in the movement of Imam Hussein. You see, these people were not against Islam only. They were against every ethical trait.
Okay.
Right? You cannot brutally and mercilessly murder unless you have no etiquette at all.
True.
When you've left every moral concept in the world and thrown it in the bin.
Yeah.
Right? These people had thrown every moral concept in the bin.
Whatever they had, yeah.
So Imam Hussein, when he rose up, he was not only saving a religion, he was saving humanity itself.
Okay.
And today when me and you can have this level of empathy, Ayatollah Murtaza Mutahhari, very nicely says, when you cry over Hussein, it is because your spirit and the spirit of Imam Hussein has united in a manner that now you understand who Hussein was. And therefore, today that we can sit and maintain our morality is because someone many years ago strove to maintain it.
Yeah.
Gave up a lot to maintain that morality. So today me and you can sit like human beings and not like wolves.
Yeah. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the Muslim Lady, and I'm with Siddiqa. We're talking about the lessons we learned from Karbala. We saw patience.
We have seen a lot of patience in Karbala. Yes. So these women, obviously, we know that, like we mentioned quite a few times, their tents were ransacked, their husbands, sons, fathers were killed. What they demonstrated was that whatever has happened, we will not let go of our patience. It is said that the patience of Imam Hussein, the patience of Lady Zainab, had kept the angels amazed. You see, a lot of the times we have a lot of difficulties that fall on us and we forget Allah. You know, in the Quran, أَلَّا بِذِكْرُ اللَّهِ تَتْمَعَنُّ الْقُلُوبُ. The dhikr of Allah brings peace to the
peace
heart.
Peace to the heart.
And this peace is also a form of patience. It gives you that patience. You know, right now the world is in a very difficult situation. Financial difficulties, war, famine, drought, COVID. We lose a lot of family members. Remember that this world is just temporary. In our community, we have a very good culture that when someone in a family dies, instead of just remembering our family, we start to recite the musibah, the tragedy of Imam Hussein. So we realize that people went through worse, but they exercised patience. And when we want to cry, like Imam Ridha says, if you need to cry over something, cry over Hussein because he was mercilessly killed.
Inna Allah ma'a as-sabirin. Indeed, Allah is with the sabirin who act with patience. Thank you so much, Siddiqa, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Several factors have impelled the surge in Chinese exports, but the most important impulse comes from China's strategic investment in digital and physical infrastructure, ranging from broadband networks in Indonesia and Brazil to power plants in Turkey and railways in Southeast Asia. We now present you an article written by David Goldman. The piece is titled, "Sino-forming of Global South Passes Point of No Return." China's exports to the largest economies of the global south have nearly doubled from pre-COVID levels to a seasonally adjusted $70 billion in June 2022, from $38 billion in June 2019. Several factors have impelled the surge in Chinese exports, but the most important impulse comes from China's strategic investment in digital and physical infrastructure, ranging from broadband networks in Indonesia and Brazil to power plants in Turkey and railways in Southeast Asia. As Western nations question the benefits of globalization, China has become the world's leading globalizer. What I call China's plan to Sinoform the world in a 2020 book has advanced so far that it is beyond the capacity of the United States and its allies to impede. 500 million people in neighboring countries now depend on Chinese technology for their communications, data processing and logistics, providing China with a nearly limitless resource of young workers for its industries and an ever-expanding export market. For China, economic outreach to the global south is key to breaking through American efforts to contain China's drive for economic predominance. The influential Observer columnist Chen Feng on 28th of July wrote, "China has to solve the problem of generating its own independent growth momentum after breaking through the critical point of the Matthew effect, the economic maxim that rich countries get richer and poor countries get poorer." Chen Feng said, "America's comprehensive and unlimited anti-China campaign can slow down China's development at the cost of a greater deceleration of the United States. But China is not only putting in place a dual cycle that is promoting domestic consumption as well as exports, adding China also divides the external export cycle into two sub-cycles, Europe and the United States on the one hand, and the Belt and Road, Asia, Africa, and Latin America on the other." What we observe in the trade data suggests that China's investments are paying off in most of the developing world. Western policymakers have been looking in the wrong direction. China's trade with the global south plus South Korea and Taiwan is now as large as its combined exports to the United States and Europe. This is by far the most important event in the world economy since the rise of China itself. The populations of the developing world are dwindling at a faster rate in high-income Asia than elsewhere. The scarcest resource in the world is young workers who have enough education to enter the world economy. When Deng Xiaoping, the Chinese revolutionary leader, began his reforms in 1979, China's per capita gross domestic product was less than $200, and just 3% of adults had tertiary education. China's message to the countries of the global south is, "You can grow like we did. If you let us build your infrastructure, install your digital economy, construct your factories, hire your workers and sell you our products." In Vietnam, Indonesia, Mexico, Turkey, Brazil and a dozen other developing countries, political leaders have taken China's offer. The Carnegie Endowment wrote in an 11th of July report on China's success in Indonesia. Many claim that China exports its developmental model and imposes it on other countries. But Chinese players extend their influence by working through local actors and local institutions while adapting and assimilating local and traditional forms, norms and practices. In the case of Indonesia, for example, the Carnegie Report says, on average, Indonesians distrust China and many Chinese firms. Yet, top telecom infrastructure provider Huawei and, to a lesser extent, China's second largest telecommunications equipment maker ZTE have successfully positioned themselves as trusted cybersecurity providers to the Indonesian government and the Indonesian nation. This has been no easy feat, given long-held Indonesian animosity towards China. Many Chinese companies have faced protests over concerns they were taking local jobs. Huawei and ZTE have suffered no such fate, nor has there been a broad coalition of Indonesian voices against using Chinese technology in critical telecommunications infrastructure. In short, Indonesians care a lot more about Chinese cement plants than they do about Huawei involvement in fifth-generation networks. Carnegie reports Huawei is training 10,000 Indonesian officials in cybersecurity. China, in effect, is delivering a turnkey digital economy to Indonesia, with everything included from broadband-based stations to training. On 25th of July, Indonesian President Joko Widodo visited Beijing, the first head of state to visit the country since last February's Winter Olympics. The Chinese website Observer commented, on 22nd of July, high-level officials from China and Indonesia held a video conference and agreed on advanced plans for the joint construction of the Belt and Road Initiative and the Global Maritime Fulcrum, and make all-out effort to ensure that the Jakarta-Bandung high-speed rail is completed and open to traffic as scheduled, and continuously deepen cooperation in the regional comprehensive economic corridor. The 145-kilometre rail link between Jakarta and Bandung is a prestige project, but it symbolises China's rising profile in Southeast Asia's largest country. China's burgeoning role in the Indonesian economy does not fit the profile of what American critics call debt-trap diplomacy. On the contrary, higher raw materials prices allow Indonesia to pay cash for Chinese imports. The country has run a current account surplus for the past 2 years. Chinese exports to Mexico now comprise 16% of the country's total and have grown as fast as China's exports to Southeast Asia. Telecommunications is a big contributor. Mexico in 2020 had 77 broadband accounts per 100 people versus just 23 in 2012. In between, Huawei built a mobile broadband network and the cost of service dropped by about three quarters. As a banker for a Hong Kong boutique, I brought Huawei officials to Mexico and Mexico's ambassador to Huawei headquarters in Shenzhen, China. Huawei explained to the Mexicans that they had a big economy but woefully inadequate broadband. The Huawei officials said, "They let us build you a broadband network and the ecosystem of e-commerce, e-finance and digital technologies that go with it, and you can become rich like China." In fact, Huawei had a published plan for the digital transformation of every country in the world. Many of them are in the advanced stage of implementation. China's investments in Mexico have risen rapidly in the past 2 years. $5.8 billion of China's total $20 billion commitment to the country was disbursed in the past 2 years, in part because Chinese companies are moving facilities out of the United States to its southern neighbour, Mexico. China's investment in Brazil, now the world's largest producer of soybeans, are considerably larger. Luis Augusto de Castro Neves and Tulio Cariello, in a 2022 book, report, as of 2020, Brazil has received more than half of all Chinese investment in Latin America, around $66 billion, with three-fourths of that investment dedicated to the energy sector, and the rest going to agriculture, infrastructure, and other industries. Turkey's imports from China have tripled since 2018. China also is the country's largest export market. The first train to Istanbul from the Chinese city of Xi'an arrived in 2019 on a line built under the Belt and Road Initiative. China's largest transport company, COSCO Shipping, brought a $1 billion controlling stake in Turkey's third largest container port. China financed Istanbul's new airport with a $6.2 billion loan. Turkey's swap line with China allows it to pay for imports in yuan rather than in US dollars. As the Turkish lira crashed last year and Turkey's dollar reserves fell, the local currency swap line became a critical source of trade financing for Turkey. China's trade with the Global South could shift to national currency in short order. By 2019, China had established $500 billion in local currency swap lines with other countries. According to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, swap lines among Asian central banks are estimated at $470 billion. Financial technology is now available to conduct retail transactions directly between Asian countries. According to the Monetary Authority of Singapore and the Bank of Thailand, in 2021, Singapore and Thailand linked their real-time payment systems, PayNow and PromptPay, enabling customers of participating banks in Singapore and Thailand to transfer funds of up to $1,000 to or 25,000 baht daily across the two countries using just a mobile number. The Sino-forming of the world has far-reaching strategic implications. China's influence in Southeast Asia is growing almost as fast as its trade profile. Indonesia has embraced China's vision of economic development driven by digital infrastructure and managed by Chinese technology providers. The Philippines elected Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos by an unprecedented two-thirds majority, partly on a platform of greater economic cooperation with China. Turkey is now an economic dependency of China, which has sustained its imports despite the collapse of the Turkish lira and rampant inflation in the country.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.